to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. I have with me today Mr. Daniel Ragusa, who is a PhD student at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's also an MDiv graduate, which is a graduate with an MDiv degree from Mid-America Reformed Seminary, where I'm teaching adjunct. Welcome back, Dan. It's good to talk to you today.
Hey, Camden. Good to talk to you as well.
Dan also writes for the blog. He's on reformedforum.org, serves as an editor for us, and not only does he write, but he also fixes all of our writing and solicits new articles and pieces from other folks. So many of you may know the name if you don't know the voice. But Dan's been on the program a few times before, so today we're going to speak again. We've got some interesting material up ahead of us, and I think everybody is going to enjoy this. We're going to be talking about a paper Dan's written titled The Trinity at the Center of Thought and Life, Herman Bovink's Organic Apologetic. So this is coming on the heels of the Reform Forum Conference, the Reformation of Apologetics, which we held October 6th through 8th. We're actually recording this before the conference. So we're a little bit out of order and doing a bit of time traveling, but we trust that the event happened. I'll bet to come back and edit this if there was some catastrophic failure. Great. Oh, we forgot to hit record. Darn it.
Oh, really?
No, I'm just saying. No, not now. I'm just saying if in the future we forget to record like the entire weekend of events. Hopefully we'll have that and some backups. Nonetheless, I know for certain that we're going to be touching on a lot of these theological ideas, but I really enjoyed reading this article, or paper, I should say, and maybe a future article or a future chapter. Who knows? Maybe we'll find a home for this.
Yeah, there's a possibility. Actually, it might be in the Mid-America Journal at some point.
Yeah.
That's not definite. We'll
yeah.
see.
Yeah. Well, good. It's good to find a home for this sort of thing. But for a moment, let's take a break and talk about a few things. We've got, as I mentioned, the conference online, and if everything went well, you can visit reformedforum.org, and there you'll find archived copies of the audio and video of all the sessions, and you can find them, download them, watch them, rewind them, listen again. It should be a good opportunity to learn quite a bit about the Reformation of Apologetics and the connection between Reformation 500 and the 30th anniversary of the death of Cornelius Van Til, who we believe is a good and faithful Reformed apologetic apologist. Herman Bovink one as well, and we'll talk a little bit about their differences and similarities today. But also, while you're on the website, please look at the donate page, reformedforum.org/donate. We are extremely thankful for everybody who contributes financially to our organization. We are a 501c3 organization recognized by the IRS as a tax-exempt nonprofit organization, and that means that your donations are tax-exempt. So if you visit us on the donate page, we have it laid out fairly well, I trust, and you're able to fill out a form. You click on the Donate Now button, and then you can subscribe if you'd like to give to us monthly or weekly or annually, whatever. You can come up with any frequency you like or a one-time gift of any amount. So we have some fun donations. We've got some $19.36 donations. We've got a continuing monthly donation of $16.89. I put a challenge out there before for some 1689ers to come out there. We've received some 1517s. So if you have a date out there or something that's just exceedingly meaningful to you, then make, you know, have a good time with it. We always enjoy getting the funny numbers in the donations, and every penny really counts and helps. We're volunteering here, you know, and we've been doing this labor for a long time, about 10 years, and we're looking forward to growing and continuing to do more on into the future, but we really need your help. So if you've enjoyed the programs and all of our resources, you come to our events and whatnot, please visit us online, help us out, reformedforum.org/donate. Thanks, everybody, for your support of everything we do here at Reformed Forum and this program, Christ the Center. Well, Dan, why don't you give us a little bit of an update? I know a lot of people listen. They've been following along, you know, since you started editing with us, but I know also a lot of our listeners know who you are and are friends with you, but maybe haven't talked to you in a little bit since you moved out to Cheltenham. So where are you at in the program, and how are things going for you?
Yeah, so I'm in my second year now at Westminster with the PhD program, finishing up the classwork. And so I have three classes this semester, and one of them, which they require you to do two external courses. So I'm doing one of them now at Villanova, which has been an interesting experience.
Wildcats. And,
yes, go Wildcats. I gotta root for them now. But
I was an owl. You could at least get a cool animal. I was
It is a pretty cool animal.
A cardinal and an owl at Catholic University of America in D.C. and then Temple Owls. But you at least got something that's ferocious.
Oh, yeah. I'll take it. And, taking a course there on the Trinity. And it's been a good experience, not coming from, your typical Reformed perspective. And so it's challenging in some ways, but I think it's refining a lot of my own thinking, and so benefiting from that. And having a course here with Dr. Tipton on Romans, which has been really good, and with Poitras on Genesis and science. Mm-hmm. And he has a forthcoming book on that topic coming out. Oh, so he's great. Given us the manuscript of it, and so we've been going over it in class, and that's been good. So look for that as it comes out in the future.
Yeah. I greatly enjoyed the external courses. You can sometimes get a little apprehensive wondering, well, what's this going to be like, especially for me, who I did the MDiv at Westminster and then I stayed and did the PhD there as well. It worked out much better for me to do it that way. I originally was looking at some other PhD programs, trying to do something elsewhere, but the Lord worked it out for me to stay. But I very much enjoyed going and taking these two external classes at other schools. And even with some very well-regarded and world-renowned scholars in their fields, one who's quite the expert on continental philosophy, Espen Hammer, and specifically the theology of time. And then John Galvin was a Catholic, and he's a world-renowned expert on Karl Rahner, who is the guy I'm studying, so that was very useful for me. But I also was very grateful for my training, because you might expect, well, you go to a seminary, and sometimes religious education and seminaries in general will get a bad rap with the rest of the world, or the academy might see them as substandard forms of education, which is not at all true. And so for me to do well at Westminster in the MDiv and the PhD, but then to go and take a PhD level philosophy class with a very regarded, highly regarded professor, you could be intimidated. But I found that Westminster was much more rigorous, and I was much more prepared. And as much as I enjoyed the philosophy class, and never even having a single hour of philosophy credit ever, undergraduate, graduate, whatever, and just jumping right into the PhD, I found I was able to hang on just fine and do well in the class. The people don't always agree with my conclusions coming from a Reformed conviction, but it was helpful to get a vantage point from outside the seminary bubble, but also to see of how thorough and rigorous a Westminster education was. And I'm sure that you've found that your preparation at Mid-America has prepared you well for Westminster, but also now your courses and your education at Westminster is helping you over at Villanova.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I could definitely echo your sentiments there. And especially at Mid-America training and Westminster training, you go into more of a, not really a secular university, I mean, it's a Catholic university, but...
Yeah, but it's pretty far out there at times.
Yeah. And so you go out there and, you're not sure exactly, has my training been good enough? And it really has proven to be very useful, both Mid-America and Westminster, and just teaching you to, especially to think critically, which, not to say anything negative about the other students, but it's like to think very critically was something that was instilled in us in Mid-America where you're reading, and especially at Westminster as well. And so being able to engage other thoughts and to discern the methodologies behind them, and then to, because sometimes things can sound very nice and can sound exactly like what you're saying, but then when you really begin digging into it, it's totally different. And so that type of thinking was definitely instilled and worked in me for at Mid-America and at Westminster. So yeah, definitely feel prepared for these courses.
And even just at a practical level, there's certainly that, the rigor and the discipline of thought and working arguments out thoroughly and being able to present them. That's something that is instilled in you in all of your PhD classes. But when I was at other schools, at Catholic and then at Temple, I found even just the bare amount of work was much less. Mm-hmm. Certainly you do a lot of reading, and you need to, and the more reading you do, the better, not just what's assigned, but trying to read widely and deeply on your subjects. But for one of my classes, I won't say which was which, but for one of the classes, we maybe had like an 8-page paper and then a final exam. That was that, and the exam had a handful of essay questions. So that was that. And then also for the other class, I think we had like a 6-page paper and then maybe a 10-page paper. And those two things made up basically your grade. You know, at Westminster, you're producing, 25 to 35 page papers. Mine are usually around 26, 27 mark, kind of about the length of the one you wrote here. Mm-hmm. And you're doing three of those per semester. And it's detailed stuff that ought to be at least on the brink of publishable. You get your grade back and you want to tweak it and fix it, but mm-hmm. you're expected, if you're going to get good marks, to do work that holds up. Right. And like an 8-page paper somebody slaps together, I mean, thinking, wow. And then I would tell the other students, they'd say, well, what do you have to do at the seminary? I said, well, you usually write this. So we're writing anywhere from 75 to 100 pages of thorough academic output per semester. And their jaws drop and hit the floor. What?
Yep.
I'm like, yeah. Yep. I'm like, really? I'm like, yeah, that's just standard. So taking this class is kind of like, man, we're on easy street here.
well, check this out. For my course, for our final, it's called the final project. So it could be a paper if you like, and I believe it's about 8 to 10 pages. Wow. Or you can put a video together.
Really?
I can make a creative video. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. For a PhD course, I'm putting a video.
Well, I think you should get your buddy Jeremy Baker involved with some Snapchat filters. And I think you can have like mouse ears and something and see how that goes.
I think, that would be great. I got to get Jeremy on that.
Yeah, they'll hand it to you. It'll be good. Good marks on that. Well, anyway, external courses are a good thing, you know, and maybe they do things a little bit differently, but I certainly learned a lot. And even just with interacting with other students, it's a useful thing. So mm-hmm. take a look at that. The THM program, usually do one external course. The PhD, you do two. So take a look at it if anyone's interested, WTS.edu for their programs. And I'm sure most other schools do roughly similar things. Well, Dan, let's talk about this class, ST733, which you took with our buddy Carlton Wynn. You wrote this, in the spring? So last semester?
Yeah, last semester.
And we were talking beforehand, this class was something akin to Trinity Ancient and Modern. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about the class real briefly and just your interest in Herman Bavinck. Bavinck is one of my favorites. I think he's one of everybody's favorites, at least people who listen to this program. And Bavinck on the Trinity is so spectacular and good. Not everyone might think of him as an apologist. I've struck with the amount of people that, you know, read Van Til and think about Van Til as the guy doing apologetics, but they don't realize, people who aren't well versed in Van Til might not know how much work he does in Trinitarian theology, or if they're aware of it, they might think he's completely novel and coming up with wacky formulas. But then also when you read Bavinck here, you realize how many implications there are for apologetics. But also, I think even not just at a formal level, but in a deep sense, there is great congruity at many points with Van Til's formulation. So much so that at some points you wonder, was Van Til just reading the Dutch of Bavinck?
that's one of the things that really drew me to think about Bavinck and Van Til, because a lot of times, we think of Van Til as being so novel, and then you read Bavinck and you're like,
exactly.
That's Van Til before Van Til.
Right. Never claimed to be coming up with this stuff out of the blue. True. You know, I think because it was so new, and perhaps maybe the first time some of these things were formulated this way in English, or because Van Til, for various historical circumstances, came to have a platform that, people heard him rather than everyone else. But he constantly would say he's merely trying to apply the theology of the Reformation and the post-Reformation reformers and all of these people in his tradition. He's just trying to apply this theology of the standards and the tradition to the discipline of apologetics. So he never came out and said, I'm the only one who's ever thought about this, the problem of unity and diversity, but it gets ascribed to him. It's kind of like Malcolm Gladwell. I don't know. He doesn't come out and say, I created these ideas of you know, if you practice something for 10,000 hours, you'll become an expert. He merely reads the, he's a sharp guy himself, but he reads the all the psychological literature, but then he translates it into a way that can be more widely distributed. But then the next thing you know, he's got New York Times bestsellers and everyone thinks he came up with the ideas. It's a right. similar issue.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of ways Van Til himself, I mean, like you were saying, he saw himself as a refiner of the Reformed tradition, like not, again, not trying to be novel and trying to be as consistent as possible. And so I do think he makes some refinements from Bavinck, but I think I've argued in other papers that I've written that there's like there's an essential continuity between them, an agreement. And yeah, I think it gets reflected here, even as we're going to talk about Bavinck's doctrine of the Trinity and then how that's going to undergird his worldview thinking. Mm-hmm. And them both being of the Dutch Reformed, having that background. And so thinking in worldview ways, you end up having a lot of similar thoughts here.
Yeah. So what were your primary sources here? I'd like to get to the secondary sources soon enough, but mostly working with, I see quite a few quotes with Our Reasonable Faith, of course, Reformed Dogmatics, but also his Stone Lectures, right? The Philosophy of Revelation.
Yeah, that's kind of the big thing. The Philosophy of Revelation, the 1908, 1909 Stone Lectures at Princeton. And so that was the main thing I was looking at. And then seeing what was the theological foundation undergirding those lectures, which you find in his Reformed Dogmatics, in his A Reasonable Faith. And and then I also came across some stuff in it's called The Sacrifice of Praise, which isn't as well known, and it's written more towards lay people in the church and for those who are about to make profession of faith. But some stuff in there as well that I used throughout this paper.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk a bit. I'd like to give you the opportunity to introduce to us Bavinck's Organic Motif. I mean, that's a title also of an article written by James Eglinton. Mm-hmm. And you interact with Eglinton and you interact with one of his students, a friend of ours, Grace Atanto. What's some of the background here and what's kind of the status of current Bavinck scholarship as it develops this organic motif? And why is this important that we consider that as we consider Bavinck's use of the doctrine of the Trinity?
Yeah, so Eglinton's work really became the kind of impetus that led me to consider Bavinck more in depth. And what Eglinton is doing is he's, I think, properly correcting a misunderstanding of Bavinck as having have been sort of schizophrenic in his own thinking, where he had these commitments to Reformed orthodoxy and to Reformed theology, but he also at times would give in to sort of modern critical thinking as well. And so.
Tended to compromise at times, right?
Yeah, compromise. Yeah. So there, what Eglinton calls a two Bavinck hypothesis. And so when people did Bavinck studies, it would be, well, which Bavinck is being used here? Or how is Bavinck being modern here? Is he being reformed here? And so Eglinton, in his work, which I think is really foundational and very, very helpful, ends up positing something that deeper, that's really unifying for all of Bavinck's thought. And that's what he calls the organic motif. And for Eglinton, he summarizes the organic motif as Trinity ad intra, so Trinity in God himself, leads to organism ad extra. And so he sees the unity and diversity in God himself, both being equally ultimate, as Van Til's going to say, or both being absolute, as Bavinck says, really the same thought. Mm-hmm. How those things being absolute in God, unity, diversity, becomes the archetype for the creation's unity and diversity. And so whereas in God you have this absolute unity and diversity, in the creation that comes from God, of course, and by his work, has this relative unity and diversity. And Sutanto, as you mentioned, he had written this, that creation displays an organic ontology of diversities in unity, precisely because in God there is an archetypal unity and diversity. And so this ends up becoming something I'm trying to think through and seeing how this organic motif is going to undergird his apologetic, especially as it comes out in the Philosophy of Revelation, because you read that work and he's constantly looking at this theme of unity and diversity in the ways in which he critiques a non-revelatory approach to science and to history, to culture. And so you begin to see this organic motif even undergirding his apologetic there. And so that's what I wanted to explore in this letter, rather than this paper.
Yeah. No, that's really, really helpful. And again, people are going to already hear some of the comparisons, as you mentioned, between Van Til and Bavinck on many of these points. Van Til, you know, in some of his more controversial formulations, I think if we actually read him and understand what he's trying to say, I don't find it really that controversial. But the formula that God is one person in three persons, he's not contradicting a creedal statement there at all. But he wants to maintain something that the Bible speaks of, that we address God, the unity of God, even as a personal God, as a person. We speak of God, and God does things. That's proper. But obviously, we know and understand that God is three persons in one essence. And those three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit, relate to one another. Sometimes the tendency can be in our minds to think of the essence as somehow more important or more basic or more fundamental, because the hypostases subsist in the essence. The essence is what is common to, it is the divinity. It's what's common to the hypostases as they relate to one another. But there can be some big issues here when we start to prioritize the unity over the diversity. And one thing I thought I loved here is how you draw together Bavinck's insistence that the hypostases are essential as well. And I'm equivocating. Mm-hmm. I'm equivocating there on purpose. But when we use the language essential, we start to say, well, if the essence is essential because it's an essence, then somehow the hypostases must not be essential, which is a very bad error. Mm-hmm. That God could exist in no other way and does not exist in any other way than three hypostases subsisting in one divine essence. That is who God is, and that's not going to change. It's one simple God, one essence, three persons, always and everywhere. And so for Van Til, but also here more specifically drawn out and made explicit by Bavinck, is these are equally absolute. The unity and the diversity are not balanced in any way. There's no fluctuation. There's no dialectic, but these are equally ultimate and equally absolute. I don't even know the word aspects or features of
limiting concepts.
Limiting concepts. That's the better way. Limiting concepts of the one simple triune God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because you read Bavinck and he's up front and in his doctrine of the Trinity, he's saying the great this is actually a quote from him. He says, "The great challenge facing us with this dogma is to see to it that the unity of the divine essence does not cancel out the Trinity of the persons, or converse that the Trinity of persons does not abolish the unity of the divine essence." That's on page 288 and 289 of volume 2 of his Reformed Dogmatics.
Yeah.
And so from the very outset, before he even begins to really dive into the doctrine and work through these things, he's saying, you know, we need to upfront make sure that we're maintaining the unity and diversity without either eclipsing or canceling out or compromising any way the other. And again, you that's something Van Til is going to pick up on and
yeah,
go as well.
Yeah. Oh, it's really significant. But then that is an archetypal paradigm, or the archetypal reality that founds is the starting point. It is the foundation stone, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is a similar word to what Bavinck uses. That has that reality is organically connected and forms the pattern by which the creation reflects.
Right, yeah. And that's we might maybe mention more of this later, but that's where you begin to see this organic motif coming out. But that's where you begin to see Bavinck's organic conception of special and general revelation. Whereas the Trinity doesn't just simply become this doctrine that gets relegated to the side somewhere, and then we go off as special revelation, then we go off and do general revelation, and go study that. But they're organically related, so that the Trinity becomes the foundation stone or the starting point for engaging in the general revelation of God and history and creation.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that quote I began the paper with that I thought was extremely helpful, that again got me thinking about his apologetic in the Philosophy of Revelation lectures, and to think about the theological foundation undergirding them. And it's in his section on the importance of Trinitarian dogma in his Reformed Dogmatics. that Bavinck speaks about the centrality of the Trinity. And he says that the Christian mind remains unsatisfied until all of existence is referred back to the triune God, and until the confession of God's Trinity functions at the center of our thought and life. And so he speaks about that doctrine as the sort of mountaintop from which we then can survey the rest of creation. And so that's sort of a picture that conveys the organic relationship between the two. Mm-hmm. So we survey creation from the lens of this triune God, not just a bare theistic God or some type of immovable mover or Plato's idea or something.
Sure. Thomas, where you have a distinction between De Deo Uno and De Deo Trino.
Right.
At least in my understanding, as De Deo Uno, or the unity of God, the one God, can be ascertained through general revelation and through the operation of reason by examining general revelation. But to come up with the doctrine of the Trinity, that's specifically something that can only be obtained through special revelation and by God's grace. But Bavinck seems to indicate, and this is kind of the revolutionary nature of what he's proposing. Not saying he's the first ever to have thought about this, but in terms of why this is such a departure from many other forms of and many other theological traditions, is because he's rejecting that difference and saying there's an organic unity between general and special revelation, and both of them exhibit, you know, Trinitarian features. Not that they're divine themselves, but they're analogs or ectypes of a divine Trinitarian archetype.
Right, absolutely.
That being said, then how does Bavinck start to develop that notion? And, you know, specifically when he starts to look at creation, he doesn't just lump all creation together, because he also has a special position for man, doesn't he? How does that fit in when you have these three types of realities, God, man, and then the rest of creation?
Right. Yeah, so he sees as basic to his worldview those three relations, God, man, and the creation around him. And just to take one step back before getting to that. So what I'm looking at to do in the paper was to sort of move from what is most basic and foundational and move upwards until we arrive at his apologetic. And so we've been talking about the doctrine of the Trinity and the equally absolute unity and diversity in God. And then the next step that he takes is moving from that doctrine of the Trinity to the creation, and so to his relationship to man and the creation as well. And it's interesting that for Bavinck, he understands, as he says, that the doctrine of the Trinity is of the greatest importance for the doctrine of creation, and that the latter, so the doctrine of creation, can be maintained only on the basis of a confession of a triune God. So that the act of creation itself requires that God be triune, that if God were not triune, that the act of creation could not have come about. And this is some stuff that I kind of want to still look into and think more about. But for Bavinck, he was making the point that without the processions within God himself ad intra, the generation of the Son, procession of the Holy Spirit, that if God was not a self-communicating person within the Trinity himself, then the doctrine of creation by which he communicates himself ad extra would be an impossibility. And by maintaining that, by maintaining the processions and the self-communication God ad intra, that allows and permits God to communicate himself ad extra without confusing the creator-creature distinction.
Sure. And that's where we have to have an analogy there. And that's where the Reformed Scholastics are so helpful to speak about archetype and ectype, very important categories. Does Bavinck develop that, interact with Calvin, considering the Son as autotheos, for example?
Oh,
because he's got this idea that, and this is what I subscribe to as well, that the Son is autotheos. He's not received his essence. His essence is not derived or communicated. His divinity has not come from the Father. It's much more of an Eastern notion. Ronner has a similar notion. You will reject that, but yet understand that his personality, as hypostasis, he is begotten, and the Father is unbegotten. The Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son if you live on this side of the globe.
Right,
if you live on the other side of the globe, the Holy Spirit does not proceed from Father and Son.
Yeah.
At least since 1956. But
yeah.
What is or 54? I might be getting my dates wrong. The schism. But what is Bavinck? Does he interact here with Calvin on this point specifically as it relates to creation? Oddly enough,
yeah. I found this to be really fascinating because he doesn't at all mention Calvin's doctrine of the Son being autotheos. And of course, we know that he was familiar with Calvin. He did Calvin studies, and obviously Calvin was influential in his own thinking. But he makes no mention, whether agreeing or disagreeing. At least I've not come across it, and I've read through it a few times.
Wow.
I've not come across him dealing with it. I know he does speak about the Father communicating the essence to the Son, which seems to
against Calvin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he makes no mention of it. Again, neither rejecting it nor accepting it. So I don't know. I've found that to be a very peculiar thing in his Unitarian theology, because it seems that that doctrine would have been useful for him in affirming the ultimate unity and diversity of God and all these other things that he's wanting to do. But then I think if some of it has to do with the doctrine of creation here and the way in which he sees like this relationship he's drawing between the processions at intra and the communication of God at extra in the work of creation and providence, I wonder if that's this analogy that he's drawing is undergirding his non-use of Calvin's autotheos, but I'm really not exactly sure about that.
Well, that sounds like another paper for someday, or a dissertation from you or somebody else.
Not speak about autotheos, and the relationship with the creation would certainly be something to explore.
It's definitely an interesting subject. It would be quite a fruitful exercise, and it may be the case where you don't find that he interacted with it much or didn't develop it himself. But then, if this theology is worthwhile, which seems as if it is, then that would definitely be something that could be useful down the road.
We've been talking about the Trinity, talking about absolute unity and diversity, how that's going to become foundational for his doctrine of creation. So he doesn't throw the doctrine of Trinity aside when he speaks about creation, but it's the triune God who creates. And so he's going to see this necessity of God being triune for him to create, grounded in both the work of creation and then the product of creation itself. So the work of creation, he's going to see that there's a unity and diversity as being equally ultimate again in the very act of creation, God creating itself. And so, not creating himself, creating the world.
We know what you mean.
Creating the world.
Someone's going to turn that into a ringtone, Dan. Bring it up at a classes meeting or something. Watch out.
We have you on recording saying that God created himself. Right. Sorry.
Yeah.
But, so the very work of creation, whereas we will ascribe it, even in the Apostles' Creed, we'll ascribe it principally to the Father, but we recognize that all of God's works are he's undivided in his work. So it's the triune God who creates. And so we find in the act of creation itself, all three acting in the one act. And so you have the one and the many. And it's not as if each contributes a certain part, so you add up all three and then you have creation, but it's an undivided singular act of the three persons. So the very act of creation itself at extra is itself reflective of the unity and diversity in God himself. So then the creation as an act of God's unity and diversity being equally absolute itself then is itself becomes has within its own ontology a relative unity and diversity in its very produce, or the product of creation itself is going to reflect something of the triune God. And just to read again some quotes here, the page number here would be volume 2 of his Reformed Dogmatics, page 422 and 23. Bavinck says that the doctrine of the Trinity provides the true light here, just as God is one in essence and distinct in persons. So also the work of creation is one and undivided, while in its unity it is still rich in diversity. It is one God who creates all things, and for that reason the world is a unity, just as the unity of the world demonstrates the unity of God. But in that one divine being there are three persons, each of whom performs a task of his own in that one work of creation. While there is cooperation, there is no division of labor. All things originate simultaneously from the Father through the Son in the Spirit. And so here, again, Bavinck is showing that the very act of creation itself demonstrates the unity diversity. I mean, it's grounded really in the unity diversity in God himself. And so then the work itself, creation, is going to have a unity diversity of its own that's relative of God's unity and diversity. But the creation's unity is going to be found in God himself, not within the creation, but within the mind of God and the plan of God and his consciousness, as he's going to say.
So he's really, in a sense, developing and using kind of Augustine's formula in a very useful way, a helpful way, but then also kind of developing a Trinitarian theology that's not a psychological model either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is what Augustine would have held to, what he did hold to. Wow. Yeah. So you say even here in the paper, just for the listeners here, the basic point is that if God could not communicate himself absolutely ad intra, and he could not communicate himself relatively ad extra. That's where we need some more autotheos to fill that out.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, another paper I've written that, and I think that's something that we talked about, how Van Til refines some of the things of Bavinck and the Reformed tradition. I think that's one thing that Van Til does refine as he again, not inventing the autotheos doctrine, but again, drawing from Calvin and just trying to be consistent with his thinking.
So the consequence of this is that creation itself has a form that is Trinitarian, a triniformity, which is a kind of a funny word that appears in Eglinton, I think, uses that, right? On page 110 of his Trinity and Organism.
Yes.
So how is that the case? Is it best to think about this as in terms of archetype, ectype, and analogy? Because you don't want to press the unity too much, because then you could end up starting to go along pantheistic lines.
Right.
And that's coming up when we start to talk about different worldviews. You have a worldview that stresses God, and then you end up with either an orthodox one or an unorthodox one, which would be very pantheistic. You have worldviews that stress man or worldviews that stress creation that are naturalistic. So what's the healthiest or best, you know, orthodox way? How does Bavinck want us to consider that triniformity without devolving into pantheism?
Right. I think it's actually quite simple for Bavinck, is that for him, he's beginning with revelation. He's beginning with special revelation and God's and what God has made known. And so that's part of that revelation is the doctrine of creation itself. And so because he draws that distinction between the processions ad intra as being the archetype for his work ad extra in creation and providence, then at fundamental to his thinking is that basic creator-creature distinction, so that you're not confusing the ontology of God and the creation. So I think it's simply just grounded in his doctrine of creation, that when God creates, it's not an extension of himself,
right?
But it's something distinct from himself, yet, of course, related to him.
But even then, absolutely that's true, but then there might be some people who would go down looking for certain triads in creation and looking for some sort of numerical specificity. You speak here about the medieval sense of numerically being specific and speculative triads, which are not the way that Bavinck thinks of his Vestigia Trinitatis or vestiges of the Trinity, that we shouldn't expect over, time and time again, that they're always triads or threes and ones.
Mm-hmm.
We might find those, but that's not the point for Bavinck, right? It's not like a math code that we should use to try to figure out the rest of general revelation.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's interesting because you have, during the medieval period with the scholastics and all that, where they're finding all of these triads, which were very speculative in the creation. And the Reformation, if you read just like Calvin, for example, on the doctrine of the Trinity, they move away from a lot of that speculation. And in a sense, they cease to even look for triads in the creation as well. But then you see with Bavinck, and I think Jim Cassidy has mentioned this in last year's
at the conference.
Conference, so maybe you want to go check that out as well, where he did some work on this. I think kind of based it off of some of Eglinton's work as well. But whereas you begin with Bovink and others begin to see a resurfacing of the Vestigia Trinitatis, vestiges of the Trinity. And for them, it's not simply finding three in one as, again, specifically numerical numbers, three and one, but finding a more relative unity and diversity. So more of a pluriformity in the creation, in which it's not necessarily has to be a three and a one, but it could be a basic diversity and also a unity. So that's what he's getting at. So whereas in God, the unity and diversity, the triunity of God, is absolutely so three in one. In the creation, you find a relative sense of that, in which there's a generic diversity and a unity that you find. So it's not a specific mm-hmm. three in one, but a generic unity and diversity.
Certainly. And, Van Til develops that very much. And how many times do we see in his writings him talking about the problem of the one and the many, or speaking of mm-hmm. unity and diversity? Or when he speaks about the kind of the dialectic or the battle between rationalism and irrationalism, everything devolving into some unspecified monism, or, breaking up into and fragmenting into complete and utter diversity, such that no two things have even any legitimate connection. Mm-hmm. He's constantly looking at creation and realizing that there at the heart of it is an issue here of relating unity and diversity. And for Van Til, that's something that philosophy has been struggling to explain ever since it began. Right. And then so the only solution, not because we've tried everything else and find it lacking, but because God has revealed himself to us, we find that the triune God is present. And he alone serves as the connecting point, or the starting point, or the foundation for all of reality as it exists, because he is equally ultimate and absolute unity and diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And he's told us as much.
Yeah, and that requires you begin with special revelation. Like, if you begin with God's revelation, not
right.
Some autonomous reasoning, which kind of, I guess, maybe a side comment, but it's interesting because Bovink is usually accused at some points, even by Van Til, of sort of having some form of realism in his mm-hmm. in his thinking. And I don't really see that. And I forget who it was. I think Matheson, I believe it was Matheson in an article. If I can find the title of the article,
I'm looking for your footnotes because exactly I'm page 22 of your paper. You talk about, he says, you write, however, Brian Matson has persuasively shown that Van Til's accusation is unfounded upon a closer reading of Bovink's work. He demonstrates how Van Til's critique is more owing to a question of style than of content. And the article is Van Til on Bovink and Assessments in the Westminster Theological Journal, of volume 70 from 2008, pages 111 to 127.
Yeah, so I'm in agreement with that article in a lot of ways, and though I'd be would still like to discuss it and try to get more clarity on the issue, but it seems that for Bovink, his beginning point is going to be special revelation, and that's his principium cognoscendi. I mean that's where he's beginning with, and. So yeah, I mean that's just kind of a side comment, but because I know others have again.
Sure. It's a debate.
Spoken about it. Yeah.
No, it's helpful, and we always need to be critical and read. There's another article here that I need to read by Lawrence O'Donnell III. Neither Copernican mm-hmm. nor Vantillian, rereading Cornelius Van Til's Reformed Apologetics in Light of Hermann Bovink's Reformed Dogmatics. That's in a journal titled The Bovink Review.
Issue you can find that
2.
Online. Yeah.
Oh, so that's published online? We'll have to dig that up and put a link to that episode.
I don't know how many issues they've had. I probably one for each year. I guess
so maybe they're on 8 or 10 or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're online, and there's some good articles in there. I believe it's with Calvin Seminary. I believe it's some of those guys. It was worth reading.
Oh, so Lawrence O'Donnell's the associate editor. There we go. I should know this. But editorial committee includes James Eglinton, George Herrick, Cornelius Vanderkooy, Dirk Van Coylen, and Brian Matson. So some heavy hitters there. Definitely check it out. John Bolt's the editor.
Stars,
of course, we've had him on the program before too. Yeah, there's no joke. Mm-hmm. We'll put a link to that in the episode description for sure. So how does this interface then with, more specifically with apologetics? I'm sure many people will start to see some of the connections on epistemology and whatnot. How does Bovink use this specifically when he's talking about worldview how this influences the way we see, consider, and even conceptualize perhaps the world?
Right. So these doctrines, you know, of the Trinity and of creation and the way they interface with one another, they're going to become the substance of his worldview. And the idea of a worldview is it's something that's developed, and especially with like Bovink and Kuiper, and something that Van Til is going to be in the line of as well. But by nature, worldview, as John Bolt says in his book on Bovink, on the Christian life, by nature, the worldview is antithetical. It opposes other worldviews. It's a certain way of conceiving the world. And so Bovink's worldview that's going to have its substance in God as Trinity and the creation as an ectypal reflection of God as triune, that's going to become his starting point from which he's going to critique other worldviews such as monism and its various expressions in pantheism and materialism and stuff. So these basic doctrines that we are considering, again, Trinity and creation, are going to provide him with the content from which he can then begin to critique other worldviews and really do an internal critique of those worldviews, which he's going to do in the Philosophy of Revelation lectures, so that his apologetic is going to come from his worldview, which is grounded in his Trinity and creation doctrines.
More or less, what does Bovink argue for specifically in his lectures, the Stone Lectures of Philosophy of Revelation then?
Right. So his basic argument is that unless you begin with revelation, unless you begin with God's revealed truth and you begin with the triune God, then inevitably you sacrifice what he calls the full-orbed nature of creation and history. You inevitably sacrifice the diversity for the unity, or the unity for its diversity. And so that apart from beginning with the triune God and coming at the creation from this specific worldview grounded in God's revelation, then again, you're not going to maintain the full orb nature of creation, its unity and its diversity. It was interesting, maybe just one comment here, because we're talking about his apologetic here in the Philosophy of Revelation. And it's interesting because we've been talking about Trinity and talking about creation and the fundamental place that the doctrine of the Trinity has in his thinking, again, the mountaintop from which we view all of creation. And yet you read his Philosophy of Revelation and you're like, he doesn't mention Trinity once. Actually, no, he does mention it once, but it's sort of a passing comment about Augustine's doctrine or his analogy. And so I was confused by that, because you have this critique that seems to be grounded in it, but he's not explicit about his doctrine of the Trinity. And it's interesting that I came across a footnote at the end of the first chapter, which was really helpful to understand it, where in that footnote he says that the present lectures elaborate in detail the fundamental ideas expressed by the author in an address on, it's the Dutch title, I'm just going to give the English translation, A Christian Worldview. I don't want my Dutch friends to get mad that I mispronounced it. So. But actually, I was teaching a class once at this church, and there was a lot of Dutch people there, and I pronounced the name of someone, and the name was I pronounced it as Jan Matthes.
Oh yeah.
And afterwards they were like, listen, it's Jan Matthes. Like I pronounced Jan Matthes, so like sounds so American.
Well, I've had my share of De Jongs.
De Jong, De Young. So anyway.
I've learned that, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, the point he's making here is that these lectures that he's giving, they're grounded in his Christian worldview, which is an address that he gave upon receiving the rectorate of the Free University in Amsterdam in 1904, so a few years earlier. And I don't believe this has been translated. I know I was working with Arjen Vrugdenhill, who's written a few things for us in the past. Mm-hmm. Who is just phenomenal with languages and just mm-hmm. amazing, and obviously speaks Dutch. He was doing some translation of it, and so he helped me work through it, even though I need to be working on my own Dutch. And in that article or that address, Christian Worldview, he is explicitly Trinitarian, and speaking about that doctrine as foundational to it. So it is a Trinitarian worldview that is undergirding the lectures here in the philosophy of Revelation. So it's, even though it doesn't explicitly mention the Trinity, it is that doctrine, which is why in that paper I go through all of those things to lead up to our discussion on the philosophy of Revelation.
So you really must have, according to Bavinck, a revelatory starting point. There's really no other option, right?
Right, exactly.
There's an organic unity between general and special revelation based on a Trinitarian character.
Right, and I think it's on page 142 of the Philosophy of Revelation, where he says, this is me paraphrasing, but the philosophy, nature, history, religion, and culture, and the future are all, quote, rooted in revelation and require it for any adequate explanation. So you're like, here, it's like he's beginning with revelation. He has a revelatory epistemology. And even the, you know, this, the whole rest of the book, this, the whole concept of the philosophy of revelation, he sees as a branch of theology, and theology itself being grounded in God's revelation. And so at no point does he simply assume or give some autonomy to the mind or to the creation apart from revelation. Mm-hmm. That's the beginning point.
Great. Well, thanks so much for bringing this up to us, Dan. I appreciate you writing it, but also introducing it. These are some fascinating topics, and we might see this in the Mid-America Journal?
It's a possibility. We'll see. No promises.
We look forward to it, seeing more of the light of day in the future, but we're glad we're at least able to capture some of the basic points and certainly pique the interest of many of the listeners. You can find out more information about Dan on our website, reformedforum.org. You can read his very helpful articles and blog posts, and stay in tune with what he's up to. Are you preaching much these days still, Dan?
Yes. I think just about every week. So yeah. This past week I was in New Jersey. This coming week we have the conference, but I'll be leaving Saturday night, because I'll be preaching
coming
in Manhattan.
In Manhattan. Where at in Manhattan, for folks who might want to know?
Yeah, it's Messiah's Reformed Fellowship. It's a United Reformed Church there. It's, I can't remember the avenue, but I believe it's on 43rd Street, but it would be more west.
Yeah.
So 43rd, I believe it's right after 7th Avenue. I can't remember, even though I interned there like 2 years ago, I was always traveling there, but I'm forgetting right now.
Yeah, no worries.
But if you're in the area, we would love to have you stop by and just check the website out. Maybe you could put a link to it or something.
Yeah. We'll let people know and they can get connected. So I'm sure we have listeners in Manhattan. Are you looking for a good Reformed church or some URC congregations? Check it out. Not only in Manhattan, but as you say, Long Island. Isn't that how you say it?
Long Island. My Long Island accent comes out once in a while, but it's I've been told it's kind of been dulled down a little bit just because I've been away for some time.
I'm giving you intentionally bad representation just to try to get you fired up, but you're too cool-headed for me. Anyway, check us out online, reformedforum.org. There's information about all of our programs as well as how to subscribe and how to get in touch with us. Visit the store as well. Our friend Ryan Noah has been helping out, and it's like red meat, and there's blood in the water with some of these wonderful used titles. First editions of Van Til, signed copies of stuff. There's a copy of Voss's Mosaic Origin, the Pentateuchal Code that got snapped up. I mean, all this stuff there's always new surprises coming online, mysteries to be revealed. ReformedForum.org/store. Do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.